My name's David Hetherington. I'm the Executive Director of PCAPA. I have to say that it's wonderful to see you all here, and we do thank you for taking the time out of busy schedules, lunchtime on a Thursday, to come and join us. I'd particularly like to acknowledge and thank our hosts, Maddox, and CEO Michelle Dixon, for very generous support today. Australia needs high-quality public debate, and it's only with the support of forward-thinking firms like Maddox that little organisations like ours can put on discussions like the one we're going to have today. So I just want to acknowledge and thank Michelle and your staff for having us here. The subject for today's event is cities, communities, social innovation, and the role of leadership in particular in building vibrant, thriving places for people to work and live. And we're delighted to have three exceptional women joining us here to share their thoughts on the theme. I'll introduce them all briefly before very quickly turning over to our resident experts. Our international guest, Melody Barnes, served as Director of the White House Domestic Policy Council in President Obama's first term. She's also worked in senior roles on the Obama campaign and transition teams at the Center for American Progress and as Chief Counsel for Senator Edward Kennedy. Melody currently holds positions at the Aspen Institute at New York University and is visiting Australia over the next 10 days as a guest at PCAPA. Few people in this country have as much experience on cities policy as Lucy Turnbull. Lucy is, of course, a former Lord Mayor of Sydney, the first woman to hold the position. She served as Chair of the Committee for Sydney, as Deputy Chair on the COAG City Expert Advisory Panel, and was recently announced as the Chief Commissioner of the new Greater Sydney Commission. Lucy served on many corporate and non-profit boards, including the New South Wales Cancer Institute and the United States Studies Centre. Annabelle Crabb, one of Australia's most insightful, wittiest observers on society politics. Annabelle writes a long-standing column from The Drum, which everyone in this room will have read. I know she hosts an insanely popular podcast with Lee Sales, and has shared a kitchen with anyone who's anyone in Australian politics. Annabelle's going to lead today's conversation, so I'll turn it over to the three of you and leave you in Annabelle's very capable hands. Thank you.
We should start by pouring water. Yep. Seems prudent. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to PCAPA and Maddox for letting me be the lucky person who gets to chat these two very distinguished women who have so much in common, really. Primarily a passion for community, education, infrastructure, how cities work. Melody, of course, has been the principal domestic policy advisor to the US president for most of his term. And Lucy has been the principal domestic policy advisor to the Australian Prime Minister for most of his adult life. In addition to her other dizzying qualifications. So I'm very pleased to be talking with both of them. I want to start with you, Melanie, because you're the guest and it's polite. I want to take you back briefly to 2009 when that new Obama administration started work full of the audacity of hope and found all sorts of things to deal with, substantial foreign policy challenges, and more significantly, a global financial crisis that had the double effect of tearing away at the world economy, but also this incredible necrotic effect on American cities in terms of hollowing them out and leaving sometimes whole areas vacant. Tell me, as a policymaker, how you started to get your head around the idea of addressing the national problem without exacerbating the local one.
Sure. Well, the first thing I want to do is to thank PCAPA and to thank Michelle and Maddox for having us here today. And it's such a pleasure to be here with you and to be here with Lucy and to be in Australia. This is such a special, special country, and my husband and I are thrilled to be here. Your question, I kind of made a face involuntarily when you asked your question, because I immediately thought back to, this was even prior to the inauguration, it was a day in December, and we were in the transition, that 87-day period between the election and the inauguration, and we had a meeting in Chicago with then-President-elect Obama, and it was 12 or 13 of us that were his senior advisors, And Christy Romer was the woman who ran his council on economic advisors. And I won't use exactly the language she used, but she said, "Mr. President, this is your oh bleep moment." And she used that to start to describe the state of the economy that we found after we got into office. We knew it was bad. During the campaign, things had started to get much, much worse. But there we were with the responsibility of not only transitioning into government, but to addressing those problems. And as she laid all of that out, we sat at that table, each of us with a different portfolio, but with a responsibility to collectively advise the president and think about what to do. And part of our goal was to obviously jumpstart the economy. But at the same time, we had to do that in a responsible way, such that the resources that we were putting into the economy, to states, to local communities, we do that in such a way that when those resources had to be pulled back, we wouldn't leave people falling off a cliff. And at the same time, we wanted to focus on the problems that had been longstanding problems for the country. So with my domestic policy portfolio, one of the first things that I thought about, that we thought about, was what could we do with regard to education and training? Because that was so critical not only to keeping people employed, teachers and others employed, but it was going to be important to innovation, to making sure that communities were vibrant, that we had a long-term pipeline of young people into young adult learners, into older adult workers who would be ready for the economy that we had. And we made a number of investments with regard to education and training at that time. Things that we ordinarily wouldn't have been able to do, but we had such mammoth resources that we had to put in for recovery that we used that opportunity for significant education reform. And we did similar things. We thought about innovation and with regard to infrastructure. We couldn't do everything we wanted. I remember some meetings with the president and the vice president, and they were like, why can't we, you know, dot, dot, dot? And there was just no way we could get it done. But we used it as an opportunity to try and focus on some of those needs as well.
And the American people historically are not thrilled with the idea of all-powerful, interfering national governments. How did you deal with that atavistic fear while you went about this process and dealt with other levels of government as well?
Right. Our current primary season proves exactly that, at least on one side of the House. Well, we knew that we had to make those investments. But I can tell you there was also a speech that President-elect Obama gave, and this was, I guess, probably December. And the senior advisors went into the speech, and everyone else had been seated. And there was a row of governors, state governors. There was a row of mayors from various cities around the country. And all of them, before the speech started, were kind of leaning forward to us and whispering in our ears, like, well, you know, if you send the money to the states, it's going to get there to where you want it to go faster. And the mayors were saying, well, you know, if it goes to the states, it'll never get to the cities. You've got to get it to us. And as a result, I use that example to say that particularly at that moment where credit was so seized, where we lost over 8 million jobs during that period of time, that there was a desire for those on the ground, mayors and governors and people that were running community-based organizations, to get those resources. The large fight that you talk about and that has really captured so much of American politics right now was happening more when you got to the House of Representatives and the Senate, which is why you see those votes being so close, because it's like too much money, too much federal interference right now. There are other and better ways to address this problem. But I can tell you that those on the ground were desperately looking for resources to go to schools, to keep public workers working, to try and deal with the housing problem and a host of other challenges that we had.
Now, discussion about coordinated efforts between multiple levels of government seems like a pretty good place to bring Lucy Turnbull in. Lucy, you have had a lot of engagement in local government, obviously. You have the distinction of being one of the very few people in Australian history to opt into the COAG process as a volunteer rather than being obliged to attend because of your consultative role to that body. The COAG conference, Melody, is a semi-regular affair where representatives of state and federal governments come together to argue, give inflammatory press conferences, and issue completely incomprehensible
communiques.
Yeah. Sounds familiar.
But Lucy put her hand up, girl. Look, I want to ask you, Lucy, during your time as Lord Mayor and of this city and since, what are the things that have made you tear your hair out, you know, the black spots in the management of local expectations through all of those tiers of government?
The problems caused by fragmentation, that you've got one local government which is in a small area, another local government which is in the other area, and there are sort of strategic problems across much wider areas, wider metropolitan areas, like delivering transport, delivering education, delivering health, delivering you know, infrastructure and good land use. And it's that fragmentation that I've always found very frustrating, because it actually has sometimes sort of absolved people of responsibility for what has really needed to be done. Like, for example, think strategically about how you plan cities to deliver the housing that people want, all sorts of housing at all price points, and how and where you deliver the jobs and the businesses and the economic growth in a spatial dimension for the future. So that is, I think, the very problem that sort of weak and fragmented governance that the New South Wales government had in mind to address when it created the Greater Sydney Commission. It's all about encouraging agencies and departments of state government to work together in an integrated and collaborative way, together with local government, together with stakeholders and community. So it's all about bringing people together. The idea is very much about government 3.0 rather than government 1.0, which is kind of like the 1970s model of government, where the state government came in and told you what to do. And that, you know, that has all sorts of, you know, risk implications when that happens.
Well, tell us a bit about the Greater Sydney Commission, because you are the commissioner.
Yes.
You seem ideally placed.
I don't have a badge.
No, you should have one. Or a sash.
Yeah.
So how does it work structurally? I mean, do you aim to create sort of policy-related corridors in particular areas?
Well, our main task is to, for this year anyway, it's a very big task, is to deliver the district. There at Sydney at the state government metropolitan level is now divided into six districts, mm-hmm. and they've got the very creative names of North, Central, South, West, Southwest, and West Central. So what one of the things we want to do is actually encourage people to come up with really, you know, quite zingy and sort of names that will sing to the communities that are inside the district. So if anybody's got any bright ideas, please see me after this meeting. But more importantly, it's actually to think at a district level, at a strategic level, those district plans are where we think at a strategic level about where we put the houses, where we, you know, build the schools, where we build the transport, where we have the infrastructure, and, you know, how we actually leverage everything off each other. And particularly, you know, I mean, it's interesting because the Sydney CBD it's, you know, touch wood, it's very prosperous and successful, and there's been a lot of employment growth in and around the city centre, which is wonderful. But we need to configure ways of actually, you know, creating the conditions for there to be more jobs growth in Western Sydney to, you know, to build out the Parramatta, to create jobs and employment and creativity hubs and health and education hubs right across the metropolitan area. So that's what we do, and we work with, you know, there are six district commissioners, there are three Sydney commissioners, and there's myself as the chief commissioner. If anybody had ever told me at school I would be a chief commissioner one day, I would have laughed them out of the room. Anyway, that's another story. But so they, and we will work closely with the government. We're independent, but we cannot actually get what we need to do done without a strong sense of collaboration with, you know, the transport agencies, the planning agencies, and all the other agencies I've mentioned before. So we need to work. If we don't collaborate, this operation won't work. So it's government 3.0.
We have a system where, I guess, lots of big transport decisions get made by federal government. Is there a blind spot there? We have a federal minister for cities. Oh, hang on. Yes, we do have another federal minister for cities now, just being sworn in about 10 minutes ago.
Well, the federal government doesn't work up the projects. What typically happens is that the state governments develop the ideas for, you know, I'm repeating. Am I too close?
We're in 3.0 formation, I think, with that speak. I'm trying to move back without.
Okay, triangulate. I don't want to throw forward.
Yeah. Is that working?
Okay.
There you go, you see? People working together.
So typically the state governments develop and, you know, and work up big transport and infrastructure projects. And then often they ask the federal government to do that. And that's the way it works. And local government's often the recipient of that infrastructure rather than somebody who's at the table. I think that's changed very much since the infrastructure in New South Wales has been developed, and the new transport master plan had a lot of community engagement about what needed to be in it. So there has been a huge, I think, tectonic shift in the way the government operates to bring the community along, and that's a really important task for the commission too, to have all sorts of interesting ways of engaging with people, not just turning up to meetings and giving them slide demonstrations that would send a hyperactive person on a psychotropic drug to sleep, let alone a normal person at 6 o'clock at night.
It's so important to have a master plan too, isn't it? It's a very reassuring term,
yes.
I think. You know,
well,
we've
yes.
had plans.
We need mistress plans though, don't we?
It could be an entirely different concept. I have a question for both of you, and it is actually about what we're talking about when we talk about innovative cities, because everybody thinks innovation is a great thing. It's one of those things with which it's impossible to disagree.
Yes.
If you're an adjusted human being. Well, what does it mean? People have all these different interpretations. I want to ask you, Melody, what does an innovative city look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are several different things that have to be focused on if you talk about an innovative city. I think one, you have to focus on people, you have to focus on place. It's important to also use evidence and data, and you have to also include collaboration and resource and investment. So by people, I think one, you also have to make sure that the prosperity that comes from innovation, we assume innovation is a good and a good and useful thing, is widely distributed. And that includes issues of social mobility, income stagnation, some of the issues that we are really grappling with in the United States. It includes education and job training. So a focus on those kinds of programs to make sure that you've got people ready and trained to participate in an innovation economy. You also have to focus on place. One, you want to find places that attract people, that people want to live and to be, and where it is easier for them to do the kind of work that creates prosperity in that place. And that includes everything from issues of livability to green communities, which also goes to lowering carbon footprints, that whole set of issues. But places that also invite entertainment and recreation, the things that attract smart young people, sustain older people and older workers, and make it easier for them to do their work. And it also includes issues of transportation that we were just touching on and infrastructure. I think collaboration and some of the work that I've been doing includes a focus on cross-sector collaboration. Mm-hmm. Complicated, challenging problems, not surprisingly, don't get solved with single sectors or single actors. So bringing together the private sector, the philanthropic sector, community-based organizations, all levels of government, I think is critical as we go about solving those problems. And I specifically mention community-based because it is important to include the people who live in those communities as you try to address the challenges and move forward in those environments. And I think data and evidence are critically important as mm-hmm. well. I mean, often people say, oh, you know, I just have a feeling that this is working. Or, yeah, you know, I think that is the answer. And smart, innovative ideas are great, but we also have to go through and use data and evidence approaches to determine, is that really working? Do we need to shift it 20 degrees to the left or 30 degrees to the right? Or is it not working at all and we need to invest resources in a different way toward that thing that is working? And then finally, I mentioned resources. How do we bring together individuals with those smart ideas and give them the resources, the investment capital, the access to wealth building so that those smart ideas can get off the ground and get some escape velocity? So those are the elements that I think are critical to innovative and vibrant communities.
Everyone approves of innovation, as I said earlier, but one of the complicated aspects of being an innovative leader is that there are aspects of redundancy in innovation too, right? Mm-hmm. So if you take a community in a new direction, you may abandon some mm-hmm. ways of life or elements of infrastructure mm-hmm. that are are outdated, and that's hard for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Is that the hardest thing about innovative leadership, do you think?
Well, I think it is certainly, it could be a tremendous hurdle, but that's why I think it's so important that that happen with the community, that you are engaging. And in many cases, I'm thinking about aspects of social change. And for example, some of the work I've done with regard to education. You will talk to people, and it's like, we've been doing it this way for a long time. We have well-intended, good-hearted individuals and organizations that have been focused on these issues and doing it in a particular way. And at the same time, and I would sit in my office sometimes in the White House and the work I do now, and I would look and say, but we aren't getting the results that we need. So how, but you can't, there are a number of different things that have to happen to try and engage and bring people along with you as you are going about making the change. And it may be helping them to move. It may be important to say, this program just isn't working, so we've got to try something else, but explaining why and moving forward together. But I often say, having good intentions but not having good outcomes, that isn't going to get you to where we need to be for the community that we intend to help.
Lucy, looking out across this city from our fortunate position on the 27th floor here, and this is a city you know very well, and one
so
about which you even wrote a book.
Yes.
Can you think of any examples of problems that have been solved in Sydney through what you would call an innovative approach, or alternatively, problems that have not yet been solved but require an innovative approach? I'm just looking for some demonstrations of what we're talking about when we're talking about innovative solutions. Yeah.
Well, I think when we're talking about innovation, as you said, innovation is a very important concept, but it operates at so many different levels. So if you're putting a spatial context into innovation, which we are now, I completely agree with what Melody says. But innovation has to happen in big businesses. And, right now, with all this digital disruption, the big businesses that haven't been innovating are, sort of much lesser terms of scale and number of employees, et cetera, much lesser institutions than they are now. So what needs to happen in cities is that there needs to be the frameworks for large companies to be able to continue to innovate and to expand into new directions and to, if necessary, contract. And for the new sort of startup or medium-sized businesses, interesting, a lot of the employment growth in Sydney has been in the small and medium-sized businesses over the last, 10 or 15 years. So we have to have the circumstances and the conditions for those small and medium businesses to feel that they can grow. Now they need, businesses feel better when they feel a degree of certainty, but they don't want too many regulations and time wasting about if they just want to go and get a lease or get a DA to, just to turn a, reconfigure a warehouse or something like that, or a small, small office. We've got to make sure that regulations are very simple. Now, what I think is very interesting with what's happened in the last, really in the last 3 or 4 years, is the emergence of a very interesting kind of digital tech cluster around UTS, which has been, I think UTS has done an outstanding business in actually being a key partner, because collaboration is so important with developing high innovation tech districts. The UTS has really been an anchor and a guiding light, especially the business school, but the whole institution really in creating the conditions and I guess the bubbliness in the business ecosystem. There's a lot of very interesting smaller startup incubators and hubs and small businesses growing up, and that's a really positive thing. There's a lot of in the CBD, for any large kind of globally focused city, there's a lot of jobs in the finance and business and professional services area, not least law firms where we are now. And there's a lot of interest in fintech startups. There are a couple of fintech incubators in Sydney. So what can government do to encourage that, especially more local and state government, which is kind of my remit, is actually to nurture and to support things like developing really interesting mixed-use districts. Think more flexibly about having buildings that have, apartments or flats plus people running small businesses inside. Don't get too fixed on whether it's residential or non-residential use. If it's non, you know, if it's a disco, obviously that's not going to work. But if you're just running, if you've got a small startup business, you should have a lot of flexibility in where you can work and how you can work. So governments actually have to get out of the way and nurture what's happening, because governments cannot mandate things. And a living example of how the innovation universe has changed in a urban context is that, like in the 70s and the 80s, people thought, oh, well, we need some innovation. We need to build business parks. Well, business parks are kind of like urban, you know, I'm sure there are some successful ones, but the really dynamic clusters now are not in business parks. They are in mixed-use inner urban districts. Mm-hmm. So we have to contain and support the growth of that mixed use and dynamism.
You talk about the UTS development, and I work in a big building just opposite.
I know, I've heard of it. I've even been there.
I know you have. But the great thing about that building is that I think half of the ABC who sit in on the side of the building that has a view of that new structure had their lives immeasurably enriched.
Absolutely.
I know I've sometimes nicked to the other side of the building to have a look at that building going up.
Well, if you're good, maybe you'll work there one day.
I would love to. Thank you for the invitation. I consider that a firm offer. but it makes me think that in all this talk of innovation and so on, we have to allow too for beauty and joy,
design, excellence in design,
a feeling of joy when you occupy a space that is allocated to you. Yeah. And I want to ask both of you quickly before I surrender the questioning authority to the audience. How do you control for that? How do you assess that? It's a very slippery concept, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that I actually did when I was in the town hall was to help embed and kind of, sort of make part of the system the idea of design excellence. And I think, you know, encouraging competition and a competitive process for large buildings is really important. But, you know, nothing, and I think, you know, that Chow Chak Wing building is just a sensational piece of sculpture and architecture. It's amazing. There are other really good ones that I was really happy to be a part of, which is the redevelopment of Central Park. I was on the design panel there. Mm. So to me, and, you know, today I was actually in another law firm in one of the old Money Box buildings in Martin Place. It's a law firm, I think it's on, you know, a mid-level, and then there's the new Macquarie Group headquarters up in the other old sort of Money Box type 1920s, 1930s buildings. There is no doubt that good design puts a smile on everybody's face, whether it's an amazing building or office space like this one, or whether it's a bike track, or whether it's a walkway, or whether it's an amazing piece of sculpture. So I think design and excitement in a city is really important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and that's my reference to place and how place is important, because it also means that people want to live there, want to be there. But a specific example, when I was in administration, one of my colleagues was a man named Rocco Landisman. And Rocco is a Broadway producer. I mean, big plays that you've, I'm sure, heard of, Rent and others that I can't think of right now, are plays that he produced. He came on board to be the head of the National Endowment for the Arts. If you know anything about the NEA, this is an agency that is always in trouble. Yeah. I mean, people love to drag the head of the NEA up and just go at them because of, you know, views of art and culture, et cetera. Rocco was very, very, he was brilliant in this and said, okay, we've got a national economic crisis and I'm head of the NEA and I don't want to be dragged in front of Congress all the time. I know that one of the things that drives communities are artists and artisans and the maker community. And not only does that attract people to a community, but literally these are people who drive economic development, drive economic value in a community, often the first people that start to turn a community around. Mm. And he developed a project called Our Place, where he focused on the role of artists and the role of culture in driving economic recovery in communities all over the United States. So as opposed to being dragged in front of Congress all the time to be yelled at because, you know, the federal government was funding something someone thought was bad, instead he was constantly being brought in front of Congress because of the value that was being created in communities all over the country because of this vision he had. And I'll just close by saying my husband and I recently just moved from Washington, D.C. to a city, a mid-sized city, about 100 miles south, Richmond, Virginia. And one of the things that's so attractive about this community, it includes the universities that Lucy was talking about, three universities, but there's an artisan maker community that is attached to the university community. In fact, one of the new presidents of one of the really vibrant universities is a cellist. But you can see the recovery of the city coming about because of this vibrant artisan community. And those who are making investors, you know, those who are bringing capital in because of tech businesses, et cetera, are saying, we are finding it easier to bring people here because of the vibrancy of the cultural arts.
Hmm. I think that's the point at which I will very unwillingly surrender my questioning authority to all of you. I do so on the absolute proviso and condition that one of you ask Melody to explain what's going on in the primaries race. I'm sure I'm not the only person who wants to gather every piece of expertise and insight into that horror show that I can. So does anyone want to kick off with a question about cities, about communities, about anything you like, really? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, and could you please speak into the microphone because this is being recorded. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was a fascinating forum. I've got a question for Melody about Ferguson, Missouri, and the fact that actually in the aftermath of that, there was quite a lot of theory that some of the problems came down to the fact that, you know, St. Louis County was divided into sort of a patchwork of multiple municipalities. How much federal government sort of work has been done to try and bring together some of those municipalities and things like that to avoid the sort of racial tensions and things that occur when you've got large black populations with, you know, 20%, 80% white police forces?
Sure, that's a great question. And Ferguson, like so many other communities, I'm sure you all have read about, seen on the news, the stories that have come out of communities as a result of, in this case, and what we've seen in other places, the shooting of unarmed African-American and Latino, typically men. But it's really sparked a conversation, again, about racial division in the United States. And I say again because we keep having the conversation and we don't often get to the resolution of a problem that is unfortunately so embedded in the DNA of the United States. And I think, one, what you saw after Ferguson and after the trial was the Justice Department. So you have the federal Justice Department going in and doing its own investigation, both of the shooting itself, but also looking at the events that precipitated the shooting and the environment in which that shooting took place. And finding that in so many different ways, there was the criminalization of poverty that was taking place there. I mean, by that I mean, as an example, individuals, if you couldn't pay a particular fine, you might find yourself, for, you know, low-level crimes, you find yourself moving further and further into the criminal justice system, literally because you didn't have the resources to be able to pay the fine or to pay to post bail so that you don't find yourself in jail, et cetera. And bringing those to light was an act of the Justice Department. And then next level set of responsibilities being taken on by the Obama administration and others in Congress and else, the National Council of Mayors and elsewhere, to say, how do we start to unearth and get to the root of these problems in municipalities all over the country? That will be, in many regards, the work of those local communities and being driven by a larger movement that says we've got to take on these issues, but that will happen community by community by community when you get to the specifics of those problems. I think what is a larger issue is how we are going to take on and grapple with issues of race and the changing demography in the United States. And that is at heart. I mean, this goes to what Annabelle was saying at the very end, the heart of, I think, much of the friction, the lack of security, the angst that's taking place that you are seeing playing out in our presidential primaries right now, and the frustration as people try and address this issue raised by the Black Lives Matter movement, by the Dreamers, which is main, predominantly a Latino movement, to say These are the kinds of impediments that are being forced on our communities by official structures. How are we going to change that? But how more broadly are we going to address the fact that these lives have not been valued, and they have to be valued for us to work in community and to address them?
Can I just add a very quick comment, Evan? I think that there is actually a spatial dimension to poverty which is completely flipped. I mean, in the 19th century, really up to the 1960s, in the US in particular, but, you know, in other large cities, you know, social unrest and poverty was highly concentrated in the inner city part. And, you know, that's why the suburbs were developed in the first place, because they were leafy and safe and everybody could live homogeneously in the same kind of environment, you know, sort of in the garden city ideal. And now what's happened is what's flipped is that poverty is suburbanized. So, you know, if you do, and I did this, I had to give a talk, and I did a sort of like an aerial, a Google kind of aerial thing of looked at all the places where there has been, you know, racial violence and very bad social cohesion. They are now in sort of like suburban, very suburban areas with kind of strip mall community centres. So there's nothing like, you know, the traditional, you know, square or park or anything anywhere within easy walkable distance, and those suburban areas have lost that character of walkable urbanity that Jane Jacobs spoke of very well in her book called The Death and Life of American Cities. And really, the longer we travel, the more we know that actually walking in a community or being able to walk in a community where you feel safe, and women are, of course, the canaries in the coal mine there, because if they don't feel safe, they're not in the street. But if people feel safe enough to be in the street, then crime levels drop, because there's a sort of a level of social amenity and engagement and contact which makes it much safer. So I think, you know, I'm not sure what the federal government can do here in the US, let alone in Australia, but if we embed in the planning and the conception of our cities, you know, creating and rebuilding that idea of walkable urbanity, and it's going to be a bit of a, it's not always easy, but if we have that as an objective, then I think that we will try to start redressing some of the spatial inequities that have become very concentrated.
Great observations. I think we have another question here on the aisle.
Joe Skrinsky. Melody, you mentioned the existence of official structures that were impediments to the Latino community, which made me think of Mr. Trump's Great Wall of Mexican Containment. And I'm wondering, two questions. One, is that an opportunity for excellence in design in this major construction?
The Great Wall of China.
And particularly a Great Wall of China becomes a tourism objective for America. But secondly, what are the chances that he gets to do it?
You know, there was a point in time that I would have said, you know, never a chance. But what is happening now in American politics has represented a level of unpredictability that I haven't seen in a very long time, if ever. And that's why I refer to this level of angst and insecurity and friction and frustration that exists. It has existed for a long time for many, many communities, but now there's a great and almost perfect storm of national security concerns, economic concerns. I mentioned shifting demography. The fastest growing populations in the United States the fastest growing population is the Latino population. The shift in the movement towards, as is often referred into the U.S., as a majority-minority country. And all of those things wrapped in this mythology that has existed but has driven America around the American dream, and people feeling like my life isn't what I expected it to be, and nor is my children's life won't be the same, and certainly very well may be worse. And if you look across the ideological spectrum, what you see are people who are reacting to that out of frustration, anger, in some cases, you know, a sense of an idealized, from their perspective, America. And that has introduced a level of unpredictability that I would say leads me to believe I don't know quite what is going to happen next. in my heart of hearts, and I have to honestly say it's mixed with my own fears, my heart of hearts, do I think that he will be the president of the United States? I don't. We have to work our way through a primary. We have to work our way through the conventions. We have to work our way through the electoral college system of American politics. But what I do see are pockets of support for him, and I think, quite frankly, people responding to his public articulation of the fears that they had privately, and that has led them to have a certain level of comfort in saying, yeah, me too. That's my concern as well. I think the person who ultimately becomes the president, I hope, will be not him, but someone who can speak to that level of economic insecurity in particular with a plan and a way forward that is rooted in data and facts, a reality for the way the American government works, and at the same time starts to speak to and starts to heal and show people that what's happening, and particularly with the diversity of the United States, is important to innovation, is important to our way forward. In fact, gives us an advantage as we think about American innovation as opposed to people trying to cling to something that never was and certainly never should be.
This whole situation seems to have produced this incredible bifurcation in politics, Melody, where between caution and recklessness, and in a weird way, the more reckless that Trump becomes, and he said, I think, a couple of weeks ago, I could shoot a guy on Wall Street and I still wouldn't lose this race, you know, seems to be engendering this incredible caution in the rest of the Republican Party because they're too frozen or
stunned,
anxious to take him on, right?
Or stunned.
Stunned as well. Is this bifurcation a temporary thing or a permanent thing, do you think?
Well, I think he is the master of what he is operating and setting rules that he has mastered in reality TV and elsewhere.
Yeah.
That others have never, that isn't the way, you know, there's a commercial in the United States, that's not the way this works, that's not the way any of this works. I mean, that no one has ever seen before, and certainly offends most people's sense of decency and belief in the way that government and the way the leader, and certainly the way that we would want the president of the United States to be, and certainly to be perceived around the world. But I think the fear is so great that it allows that among pockets of the American population that would allow him to say or do anything, nothing has stuck, that allows him to do and say anything without repercussion. But others, for the most part, are like, A, I don't know how to fight under those rules because that's not who I am. B, I don't think that's who we should be. But C, I don't know right now how to beat him at his own game. So that leads to a voicelessness that has emerged, but at the same time an inability thus far to find a way to master him as we go through the primary process. I mean, we'll see. We've got several weeks of primaries left, and we have what, you know, we call Super Tuesday and March 1st, and all of that's coming up, so we'll see what the numbers look like. But, you know, when you've got a bully, often people don't know how to respond and certainly how to beat a bully at a bully's tactics.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it, Lucy, when people's sense of estrangement from their own community or government gets to the point where this is the way they can express it.
It is, and it's. I'm watching this phenomenon from afar. It is really amazing, and I think Melody put a finger on it. I think what he's doing is he's using the tools that he's learned from his reality TV show, which makes me wonder what Shane Warne's going to do after he's done his thing.
Probably run for Clive Palmer's seat.
But you know, all those tech, you know, that sort of, you know, that what's it called, the boss or whatever it's called. Anyway,
the apprentice. Yeah.
You know, that sort of that's how he deals with people in a public forum too. Mm-hmm. So he's done a lot of it. So he's seasoned at that mode of engagement, and that's why it's working so well, I think.
Yeah, and if you're feeling trod upon, if you're feeling that the game is rigged and you're a victim once more, and then there's someone who's saying everything unbridled, punching back, I'm tough, we're going to be great. You're like, yeah, yeah. And, you know, everything else that is decent or even tethered to react to fact, you know, forget that. That guy's going to stand up for me. And I think that that's what's driving this in parts of the American psyche. It is a, I can tell you, a highly disturbing phenomenon for many, many people. And, you know, for many, many, many Republicans who, you know, my husband and I talk to, who say, this can't happen, this isn't going to happen. And we look and like, this is happening. So what's going to happen next?
All of which is a pretty potent demonstration that people in communities are looking for leadership, and it would be prudent to supply it before they're forced to go looking for it in the reality television community. Tragically, I think we have just about exhausted our time allocation. I would thank both of you for participating, and I feel very strongly about that, but I know that David, too, is keen to... Michelle is going to do that. I'm sorry. My apologies. So I might just sit here passively while that's done for me.
Thanks. And it is indeed my pleasure to give the vote of thanks to our speakers today, Melody Barnes, Lucy Turnbull, and also to our facilitator, Annabelle Crabb. I would like to point out that both Melody and Lucy have practiced as lawyers, so it came as no surprise to me that, you know, you've spoken today with such intelligence. Thank you. I should also point out that Annabelle studied law but spurned a career in the law for a career in journalism.
I've got the bit of paper. Never used. Never used.
There are various things I could say. I was going to say, you know, Annabelle, if you wanted to have a chat about a change of career, but after your earlier comment, I'm a bit nervous to do that. Lest you take it as a firm offer. Today's session really was, I think, a stimulating and wide-ranging discussion about issues affecting many countries and issues well beyond urban development. And although the conversation around Donald Trump perhaps wasn't quite on point, it's fascinating nonetheless, and the question that we probably all wanted to ask. So you almost got there to the primaries, Annabelle. I'm also grateful, Melody, that you mentioned livability, because that's my segue to say that I am a proud Melbournian, which is one of the most livable cities in the world, or the most livable city in the world. But even in Melbourne, I think we're grappling certainly with infrastructure issues and population growth. And I know my commute to work's gone from about 20 minutes to 40 minutes over the last 5 years. Lucy, I'll be fascinated to see whether your views change around urban development now that you're spending at least part of your time in the world's most planned city. My one issue...
Oh, yes. No, Canberra is the coolest little capital in the world.
It's quite extraordinary.
It's amazing how that's changed in 10 years.
We have an office in Canberra, and my one gripe is the footpaths. My first visit to our Canberra office, I was wearing stilettos, and that didn't work out so well for me when I went out to get a coffee. At Maddox, we're very, very focused on public law. Almost half of our revenue is derived from various levels of government. So we're firm believers that public debate is absolutely necessary and required for the development of public policy. So absolutely delighted to host today, and I'd like to thank Per Capita for the opportunity to do so. And I'd ask that everyone join me in thanking our speakers and facilitators.